I invite your attention this evening to John chapter 6. John chapter 5, up there on the board, but it is John chapter 6. And we're going to talk about a story, and I've got the wrong one pulled up here. And we're going to talk about Jesus walking on the water. We may not have a presentation this morning, but I may have sent the wrong one to me. Well, we may have to go old school then without the projector, because apparently I don't have it with me. I have the wrong one. So we're going to turn to John chapter 6. But we're not going to spend a lot of time there, because there's actually three different locations that the story is told. We're going to look at Matthew, we're going to look at Mark, and we're going to look at John. And so as we go through, we're just going to quickly go through. I've almost got them grouped together. Y'all would have been really, really impressed if I had the PowerPoint with me, because I had them all color-coded. I had Matthew in red, and I had Mark in brown, and I had John in blue. I'm going to tell you, it looked really, really good on this piece of paper. But unfortunately, we'll just have to do it without the projection. So we're going to talk about Jesus walking on the water. You know, that phrase, walked on water, I mean, we hear that all the time. It's greatly ingrained in our pop culture. And so I heard it said that out of all the stories in the Bible, that's probably the most well-known. Even for people who don't know anything about the Bible, they know about Jesus walking on the water. And I came across a meme or a motivational poster. When you feel like you're drowning, don't worry, because your lifeguard walks on water. And you see things like that all the time. There's a Randy Travis song about he thought he walked on water. You may remember that song from a few years ago. There's a rapper by the name of Eminem. I don't know if you ever heard of Eminem. Some of the younger have. He's got a song about walking on the water. There's a rock band, 30 Seconds to Mars. Okay, that one's a new one. I don't know who that is. But they have a song about walking on the water. Then I found this one was interesting. This was last September. Joel Osteen. A lot of people have heard of Joel Osteen. I believe he's down in Houston. Has one of the big mega churches. So somehow Joel Osteen got tied up with a guy by the name of Kanye West. And if you've never heard of Kanye West, that's probably not a bad thing. He's a musician as well, who's married to a guy by the name of Kim Kardashian. And if you've never heard about the Kardashians, again, consider yourself blessed probably. But somehow Joel Osteen and Kanye West did some promotion, kind of in the middle of one of Joel Osteen's sermons. They walked on the water. So Kanye and Joel Osteen were walking on the water. This was back in September. It kind of raised a big fuss, because here's Joel Osteen and Kanye pretending like they can walk on water. They had some illusion or some trick that they were doing and made a big spectacle of themselves. Probably the most well-known of all of the miracles of Jesus, though, the idea of walking on the water. For a text, though, I want to start in John chapter 20, because I want you to remember this verse. This is at the very, very end of the writing of the book of John. John 20, verses 30 and 31. And here John is going to explain the purpose of his writings. It says, "And truly Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which were not written in this book. But these are written that you may believe." And then he gives three parts of it. Listen to what he says. "But these are written that you may believe that, number one, Jesus is the Christ. Number two, the Son of God. And number three, that believing you may have life in his name." So keep that in mind as we kind of go through this narrative. John is trying to prove that Jesus is the Christ, that Jesus is the Messiah. This morning, in Paul's lesson, we're talking about how Jesus is the prophet. That this is the prophet that's coming, that Jesus is that promised Messiah. And number two, that Jesus is the Son of God. And the fact that he is the Son of God means that he's got abilities, he's got control over things that other people don't have. He's got control over creation, he has control over nature. And we're going to see that in our story this evening. "And that you may have everlasting life in his name." So remember those three as we go through our lesson this evening. For a little while, though, we'll study here for a little while. It's not a real long lesson. But let's take opportunity right now at this time to go to God in a word of prayer. All right, after a slight technical difficulty, we are ready to go. Had it in a different spot on my phone. We're going to bounce a lot off the same way of Paul's lesson this morning, because these two events happened very, very close in time. So a lot of the things that you can pick up, some kinds of technical little ideas and little thoughts, and just add some detail to the story, it's going to be the same thing that we heard this morning. I do have to disagree. One little point, it's not in Luke. Luke does not record where Jesus walked on the water. So I have the three. Matthew 14, Mark 6, and John 6. And so I've color-coded. So I kind of put a little code down here in the bottom. So as we're going through these slides, if you're wondering where it's coming from, anything that's in red is Matthew's account. Anything that's in brown is Mark's. Anything that's in blue is John's. And so that's kind of how I've got it. But those are the three chapters that I'm referencing in our lesson this evening. Okay, so let's set the scene. This is what Paul talked about this morning. Major, major event occurred. And that was the feeding of the 5,000. Okay, so, and really it wasn't just 5,000, as we learned this morning. It says it was 5,000 men, notwithstanding women and children. So I don't know how many people were fed. 10,000, 15,000, I don't know. They probably were all clumped together and assembled, because it was almost the time of the Passover. John makes sure to tell us that it was almost the Passover, in which case they would have been traveling from the north down to Jerusalem. We've also been reading from the book of Psalms, and we've been reading what are called the Song of Ascents. So I'll try to put a little bit more to it. They were probably singing as they went, and they were probably singing the Psalms that we've been reading for the last 2 weeks. It's Psalm 120 through Psalm 134, I believe, are known as the Song of Ascents. And most people think that's in reference to the songs that were sung by the pilgrims as they went up the mountains into Jerusalem. So what we had in our reading this evening may have been the songs that they were singing as they walked around the lake this morning to go try to find Jesus. Who knows? It kind of puts it all together. But this event led many to desire to set up Jesus as an earthly king. They still just didn't get it. And that's kind of what we're going to pick up in our story this evening. So again, this is what it'll look like. I've just kind of interspersed the different authors. So blue, John. Mark is brown. Matthew is red. Therefore, when Jesus perceived that they were about to come and take him by force to make him a king, he departed again to the mountain by himself alone. You notice I've kind of got a couple words underlined. Mountain and alone. I still remember Nathan Batty's. He gave that sermon about mountains. There is so much that occurs in mountains. I don't know why. But God is very specific. And mountains are important. And so here we have another example. Jesus did this quite often. When he needed to get alone, he liked to go up to the mountains. And whatever, that's the spot where God seems to commune. That's where Moses went to get the commandments. That's where Jesus went to be transfigured. And we can just get example of going up into the mountains. And that seems to be where God likes to connect with his people. It also says he went alone. So Jesus needed some alone time. So we've just had this huge old situation, the feeding of the thousands, this miraculous feeding we discussed this morning. And then everybody wants him to be king. And so Jesus knows there can't be a kingdom without the cross. And so Jesus needs to get away. Jesus actually had tried to get away a little bit earlier, remember, but the people had followed him. But he was already trying to kind of back off a little. He just needed some downtime. He needed to be alone a little bit. Some people think part of the reason is, and it's hard to tell the chronologically here, but it seems to be that word had just reached Jesus about the death of John the Baptist. And I think that kind of hit Jesus. That was his cousin. That kind of hit him a little bit hard. And I think he wanted to pull back a little bit. The people followed him. He had compassion on them. He went ahead and fed them. But now he's pulled back again, and he has gone up by himself in the mountain. Immediately, he made his disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side, to Bethsaida, while he sent the multitude away. And when he had sent them away, he departed to the mountain to pray. How long did it take him to send the crowd away? You ever thought about that? It's not like he said, okay, y'all go on home. There's 15,000 people here. There's 15,000 people set in companies of 50 sitting around on a mountainside. Jesus sent his disciples away and said, y'all go into town. Y'all go to the other side. He said, I'll take care of the crowd. I got into a situation yesterday. I got to help clear the gym out after some irate parents didn't like the way the basketball game ended for the other team. And that was about 25 people. It takes a while to clean stuff out like that. Imagine trying to get rid of 15,000. So Jesus was the one that said, he sent the multitude away. And so I'm sure this took a little bit of time. So the apostles have a pretty good head start. They get in the boat and away they go. Now what's that word immediately mean? You ever thought about the word immediately? As you read these accounts, Mark likes to do it and John likes it. They like to use the word immediately. After this, immediately. And they're trying to keep it moving. My question is, does immediately mean instantly? You might think that's kind of a weird question, but I think you'll see at the end, there's some people that kind of have some different opinions on this. I feel like this word immediately just means the next step. There's not a lot of time in between it. It's the next step. And so he gets ready to go pray. The next step, he disperses the crowd. He tells the apostles to leave. The next step, he gets himself ready to pray. Now when evening came, he was alone there. So now we even know what time it is. We already know that it is Passover is near. Passover fell in what we would call March and April. It would depend on the Jewish calendar when it would hit. Somewhere in that ballpark, so it's before then. So I don't know what month it is, but maybe let's say it's late February, early March. Northern Hemisphere, and evenings, probably going to get dark about, 7 o'clock? Somewhere around there. So we can kind of have a good visual of this now, so now when evening came, so by the time 7 o'clock or so, starting to get dark, the crowd has been dispersed, and the apostles are in the boat going across the lake, and Jesus is alone on the mountain to pray, which he did many times. Jesus spent many, many hours in prayer. Now, if there's a lesson there, if Jesus needs to pray, then don't we all need to pray? Probably spend more time in prayer. Similar map to what Paul showed you this morning. Again, here's some of our towns. There's that Bethsaida up there by the Jordan River. There's your Sea of Galilee. There's Capernaum. We're going to read about Capernaum. Gennesaret. Sometimes they call this the Sea of Gennesaret. The map that's right here shows Tiberias. That's what the Romans called it. They called this the Sea of Tiberias as opposed to the Sea of Galilee. They're all in reference to the same thing. So let me give you a little bit of Sea of Galilee trivia time right now. Also known as the Sea of Tiberias. About 13 miles long, 8 miles wide. It's interesting. It's one of the world's lowest lakes in terms of elevation. We were studying in South America about one of the world's highest lakes. It's up there in the mountains. This one is one of the lowest lakes. It's actually below sea level. And so there's mountains on both sides of it, and it kind of sits in a bowl, which makes for some real interesting storms that flow in. These winds start flowing in, which we're going to read about here in just a second. Now this I didn't know. Here you go, Mike. I always try to find something to keep you awake. The Sea of Galilee is involved in 2 Muslim end time prophecies. I didn't know that. So those Muslims, they're really keeping an eye on the Sea of Galilee. It has to do with Gog and Magog. That's the first one. That's over in Ezekiel. And it's also in the book of Revelation. Gog and Magog are names kind of put to the enemies of God's people. So it says Gog and Magog and the drying up of the lake. And so the Muslims believe when the Sea of Galilee dries up, that's when Gog and Magog are going to appear. And they've been really watching it, because guess what's been happening to that water level? There's been a severe drought over there. And they say that thing has dropped big time. And so all the Muslims over there are saying, yeah, here we go. For whatever that's worth. They also believe when the drying up of the lake occurs is a separate prophecy, that's going to be the appearance of the Antichrist. And so that is from Muslims. So if you hear anything about the Sea of Galilee and the water levels, that's what they're talking about. It's something that is part of 2 separate Muslim prophecies. Now when evening came, the disciples went down to the sea, got into the boat, and went over the sea toward Capernaum. Now when evening came, the boat was in the middle of the sea, and he was alone on the land. I got a couple words underlined here. So when evening came, what time is it? 6 o'clock? 6:30, I don't know, 7 o'clock, 7:30, it's already starting to get dark. The disciples did what they were told to do. They had to leave where they were, went down, got into the boat. I don't know how big of a boat it was. I don't know how long it took to get the boat ready. I wondered, did the boat have sails on it? I don't know. I don't know what size it was. I know they could row the boat, but I don't know if it started out with sails. They'd already been back and forth across the lake several times. And Peter and Andrew, they were fishermen. They spent most of their lives on this lake. I mean, this was not uncommon for them. They knew what they were doing. So they got into the boat, and away they go. When evening came, though, the boat's in the middle of the sea. That's kind of a silly question here. Okay, that lake was 8 miles wide. Does that mean that they were 4 miles in? Is that what that means when it says the middle of the sea? Do we have to take things that literally when we're reading a narrative? Does that word middle mean exactly in the middle? I said no. Of course not. We're just trying to explain the story. I think sometimes we can get caught up in details. And a lot of the guys I read, I think they read way too much into it. So I would suggest that you be careful. They're in the middle of the sea. They're out a pretty good ways. And I don't think that means exactly that they measured it exactly 4 miles in. So just keep that in mind. Sometimes the words, it's just part of the narrative. We need to be careful that we don't read things that don't exist. Now we find out by John's account, and it was already dark, which makes perfect sense now. By the time that Jesus has got the crowd of 15,000 people dispersed off of the hill, only a couple hours I would assume to do that, finally he gets himself ready to pray, and it's already dark, and Jesus has not come to them. And so now here we go. They've gotten in the boat. They're rowing across. They're letting the sail, the wind taking across, whatever the case may be, and they're going over towards Capernaum. So they're just going over across the top of the lake. They're not making a huge old run. This is something they do all the time. So again, the song that pops into my mind is the silly theme song of Gilligan's Island. Now they're going on a 3-hour cruise. I don't think they're expecting it to be that long of a trip. Probably not even 3 hours. But that's not what was going to happen. They were going to run into some difficulties along the way. Then the sea rose, John says, because a great wind was blowing. Very, very common. They say these storms can really pick up over there because of the elevation. It says down in the bowl, when those storms start hitting, it really blows stuff around. I learned a new word this fall. We were studying about hurricanes in my little 6th grade class. And we were talking about different hurricanes that were hitting. There was one, I don't remember what the name was now, that hit over on the eastern coast. Have you ever heard of a medicane? M-E-D-I-C-A-N-E. A medicane. Had never heard of such a thing, but they exist. That is a Mediterranean hurricane. Never heard of such a thing, but they have it. One of them hit Athens, Greece this past year. Had no idea that they had medicanes. But a medicane, it doesn't have as strong of winds. They're typically about 80, 85 mile an hour winds. It's enough to get your attention when it blows onto land. So, I don't know if this was a medicane. I don't know if this was just some kind of storm that blew in off of the mountains. But whatever, we've kind of got an issue now because now this Sea of Galilee is getting all turned up. Matthew says, but the boat was now in the middle of the sea, tossed by the waves, for the wind was contrary. So I don't know what kind of wind it was, but it was whipping them around. And so now they are just trying to survive. They're trying to stay on the top of the water to keep that boat upright. Interesting verse here from Mark. He says, then he saw them straining at rowing, for the wind was against them. Wait a minute. I thought they were in the middle of the lake. I thought they were, I don't know that they were 4 miles in, but they're a pretty good ways in. Jesus is on the land. And didn't it already say that it's dark? So how is Jesus in the pitch black night seeing these people struggling, rowing on a boat in the middle of the lake? And he can't spotlight them. I mean, there's no light. How could Jesus have seen them on the boat? And I'm telling you, that's another miracle. Now that's a miracle that nobody ever talks about, is that Jesus was able to see them in their predicament on the boat in the middle of the night when it was dark several miles away. I know when I get at night, I can't hardly see 25 foot in front of my face. I can't hardly even read the road signs at night with help of my headlights. These fellas are miles away from Jesus in the dark, yet Jesus is able to see them straining with their rowing. So I don't know if they had sails, but whatever, the sails are now down because the wind is contrary. It's just kicking them all over the place. So they're having to count on rowing with their oars to try to be able to take care of them. And I don't know what time it is, but he says it's night. He says it's dark, and Jesus has still not come to them. Now, in the fourth watch of the night, Jesus went to them walking on the sea. Okay, this fourth watch of the night, that's Roman. Okay, that's a Roman translation or timing. It's typically between 3 to 4 a.m. So Jesus saw him at evening, and then when it got dark, he saw him, but he let him sit out on the lake for several hours. It was not instant. It was not immediate. And so we've gone from evening to now that it's dark, and now we're in the fourth watch of the night. So now it is 4 or 5 hours later. They've been stuck out there to kind of struggle on their own. I don't know if I ever picked up on that before. So when they had rowed about 3 or 4 miles, they saw Jesus walking on the sea and drawing near the boat, and they were afraid. So I wonder how long it took them to row that 3 or 4 miles. I don't know. They just have a machine I've done, a rowing machine, if you've ever done one of those little exercise machines, in perfect conditions, in an air-conditioned room, sitting down. It takes about, if I remember, I think like 5 minutes to row 1 mile. And that's not easy. Could you imagine trying to row a boat in choppy waters with the wind spinning you around in all directions? I mean, this is not something that happened overnight. They've been out there several hours fighting the storm, trying to stay alive. Now, this last phrase that Mark uses, he adds a piece to it. He says, and he would have passed them by. It says he was walking on the water, and he would have passed them by. I don't really know what that means. I guess he was walking toward the boat, but he wanted to make sure that they knew that he was coming. But it says he's just kind of on a path, I guess, to walk right past the boat. And that part I don't really understand. I don't know why he adds that detail. I don't know exactly what it means. And when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were troubled, saying, "It is a ghost." And they cried out for fear. Now, I don't know what you think about ghost stories. I don't know if you believe in ghosts or don't believe in ghosts. When Jerry Dickinson was here a couple years ago, he has a lesson on this. And so I kind of re-listened to it. And Jerry went through about a 10-minute dissertation about ghosts, as only Jerry Dickinson could do. I don't know what you feel about ghosts. Jerry says he didn't believe in them. I don't believe in them. But I'm going to cut these guys a little slack. Because if I was in the middle of a sea trying to survive, I've been out there for several hours rowing, trying to get the boat under control. The sea is whipping and there's wind everywhere. And I see somebody walking up on the water. You know what? I might say the same thing. I might have thought it was a ghost too. I don't know how else you would explain it. I don't know how else you would describe it. But they look out and they see someone walking on the water. They're crying out for fear because they think it is a ghost. They don't understand what is happening. But immediately, Matthew tells us, Jesus spoke to them, saying, "Be of good cheer. It is I. Do not be afraid." What about that phrase, "be of good cheer"? Heard that before? Now, I think Jesus used that phrase on purpose. Because that's been used several times in the Bible. One, now it may not translate exactly quite the same because we're translating from different languages. But remember Joseph when he was in Egypt? And the brothers came in, and so he kind of messed with them a little bit. He put one of those golden cups inside of one of their bags. And then they sent off and he had them arrested because they had one they'd stolen from the Egyptians. Well, when that all kind of got settled up, that's what Joseph said. "Peace be with you. Do not be afraid. Be of good cheer. Do not be afraid." Pretty much the same translation. Isaiah 35:4, that messianic prophecy. "Say to those who are fearful hearted, be strong. Do not fear." Be of good cheer, in other words. "Behold, your God will come with vengeance, with the recompense of God. He will come and he will save you." And now let's get to where we kind of the same language going on. What about the paralytic on the bed? Matthew 9:2. He says, "Son, be of good cheer. Your sins are forgiven you." What about the woman who touched his garment? Said she had an issue of blood for some it was 14 years, came up and touched his garment. Be of good cheer, daughter. Your faith has made you well. I don't think Jesus chose those words, be of good cheer. I don't think he chose them just out of the blue. He's trying to prove a point here, that Jesus is something special. That he is more than anything else. You can trace him back to Moses. You can trace him back to Joshua. You can trace him back to the prophet Isaiah. He's trying to make a point to all of this. I also don't think it's coincidence. One of these passages talks to the son, and the other talks to the daughter. But there's no difference between man and woman in this dispensation of time. Salvation is open to all. Salvation is open to the Jew and the Samaritan. Salvation is open to man and woman. Salvation is open to the slave master as well as the slave. And that was something that was very, very different. And those Jews didn't quite know how to handle that. So he says, be of good cheer. For they all saw him, Mark says, and were troubled. I bet they were. I bet they were troubled. I bet they're scared to death. But Jesus said to them, it is I. Do not be afraid. Okay, now this little it is I, kind of hard to translate a little bit. It's very similar to what happened with the woman at the well. It doesn't quite pop out as much as it does in probably the original language. Do you remember the I am? Because that's what he's saying. He's saying the I am. Go back to Exodus 3 and 14 with the burning bush. God said to Moses, I am who I am. That's what he's saying. Just like he did to the Samaritan woman at the well, John 4 and 26. I who speak to you am he. Okay, it doesn't quite have the same pop. But that's what he's saying. Literally, it's translated, I am. This is who speaking to you is the I am. When Jesus is doing that, he is claiming to be equal with God. He is saying, I am. I am the I am of God. That makes sense? And so in the same way now, he's doing it again. He's saying, I am. Don't fear. I am. I'm God. So go back to that passage here in John. John chapter 20, what was the purpose? Why did he write these things? So that you may believe that, number one, Jesus is the Christ. He wants everyone to know that Jesus is the fulfillment of those prophecies. And that's why he goes back to Isaiah. And that's why he says things like, I am. And he traces it all the way back. He wants everyone to know that he is the Christ. He is the Messiah. He is the prophet. But what about the Son of God? Jesus has to also prove that he has control over creation. And in doing so, he is definitely the Son of God. Only Matthew records this part of the story. He's the only one that talks about Peter. It says, and Peter answered him and said, Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water. So he said, come. And when Peter had come down out of the boat, he walked on the water to go to Jesus. I underline that word, if. Peter was at least willing to stand up, but really, Peter had to say, if you are the Messiah, if you are Jesus, if you are the Christ. I mean, he didn't know. He couldn't tell by then. Jesus has already calmed the water once in an earlier episode. He just fed 5,000 with two barley loaves and some sardines. And then now he's seen Jesus walk out a couple miles onto the water. And he says, now, if you are Jesus, really, come on. But Jesus didn't seem to get too mad at him. I guess he had understanding of it. But he tells Peter, come on, go ahead and come on out. And so Peter did. He got down out of the boat, and away he went, walking on the water to Jesus. It says, but when he saw that the wind was boisterous, he was afraid. And beginning to sink, he cried out, saying, Lord, save me. And immediately Jesus stretched out his hand and caught him and said to him, O you of little faith, why did you doubt? Okay, the wind's still blowing. At this point in the story, the wind is still going crazy. The water is still choppy. The waves are still bad. And so Peter still, he's fine. He's walking around. But then it says he started looking at the wind. Which I don't know how you look at the wind, but it says he saw that the wind was boisterous. I'm guessing he saw what the wind was doing to the waves. And then he said, wait a minute, I'm not supposed to be here. And it's like he had that moment of realization, kind of like Wile E. Coyote used to have when he realized that he could run all day off of the cliff until he realized that he wasn't on the cliff, and then he would fall. I think it's kind of the same idea. He realizes, wait a minute, I'm not supposed to be here. I'm supposed to be sinking. And sure enough, he begins to sink in the water. He cries out to Jesus. Jesus reaches out his hand, catches him, and then hits him with, "Oh, you of little faith." Again, something that Jesus, that comment is made several times in the New Testament. He likes to come back to, "Oh, ye of little faith." Mark tells us that he went up into the boat to them and the wind ceased. See, Jesus has now control over creation. Yes, he's not just the Messiah. He is the Son of God. He has power over creation. He says, and they were greatly amazed in themselves beyond measure and marvel. I'm sure they were. They couldn't contain themselves, that they were so impressed with what Jesus had done. And then those who were in the boat came and worshipped him, saying, "Truly, you are the Son of God." I want you to start noticing in our reading, anytime you come across the word "truly," because what that is in reference to is, okay, it's true. Now I know it's true. It's been verified. And so things have finally been verified that Jesus is, in fact, the Son of God. John then tells us, then they willingly received him into the boat, and immediately the boat was at the land where they were going. So again, my question is, did the boat instantly appear back at the shore? Remember, it's several miles in. Did it immediately, did they end up back at the shore? Some people say yes. Some people say, well, that's just another part of this miracle, that Jesus was just able to transport them where they were to the shore. My question is, does immediately mean the same as instantly? I'm going to go with no. Some people think so, and I don't know that I can disagree with them. But just looking at the way immediately, I don't know if you noticed it, I read it about 5 times in this discourse. Immediately, Jesus reached out his hand to pull up Peter. Immediately, they did this to go buy the food. I don't know that immediately means instantly. I think it just means the next step in the process. The next step. And so when he says they received him into the boat, and immediately, for me, I think that means that the next step is, I don't think it's supernatural. I think they made it back to the shore. Some people disagree. Some people think it means instantly they were back at shore. Whatever the case, it's an outstanding miracle. One more part now comes from Mark. It says they marveled. They marveled, obviously. And then he says this, for they had not understood about the loaves because their heart was hardened. That's an interesting concept. Because they had just had this feeding of the 5 to 10 to 15,000. Remember the 2 barley loaves and the 5 fish? And apparently it says that they really didn't understand how awesome that was. I don't know if they really picked up. It says they didn't understand about the loaves. Not necessarily their fault. It says because their heart was hardened. There were just certain things that they did not understand. They just weren't allowed. They couldn't see it. God kind of prevented them from really understanding it. Mark 16 and 14, after Jesus' crucifixion, his resurrection, says later he appeared to the 11 as they sat at the table, and he rebuked their unbelief and hardness of heart because they did not believe those who had seen him after he had risen. So that's what's kind of a long-standing problem they had. Remember the resurrection? Jesus goes and talks to different people. They all run back to the apostles, and the apostles are like, "Yeah, I don't think so." They didn't believe it. They just couldn't quite put it all together. And maybe part of that is just God not allowing them to see everything. But I don't know. It says they didn't really understand the whole idea of the 2 loaves. Interesting. So I got you a couple lessons here very quickly, and then we'll close our sermon. Sometimes we all need a little long time. Jesus just needed to get away from people. Jesus needed to go up to the mountain and pray. And I think everybody needs somewhere to go. Everybody needs to find something they can do to be able to have some alone time. Nothing wrong with that. Remember, Jesus could see them 2 to 3 miles away in the darkest of night. Jesus can see us in our darkest hour. Jesus can always see us, no matter how difficult it may be. Number 3, our time and God's time are 2 different things. And we need to remember that. Paul's reference to the celestial vending machine. We want things on our time. And God's time and our time are not always the same. Jesus let them sit out on the lake for a while. Jesus didn't walk out to them immediately. Probably not within an hour. Probably not within 2 hours. Probably not within 3 hours. Jesus led them out there. They left in the evening. And then they had trouble by the time it was dark. That's when he saw them struggling. And he didn't make it out there till the fourth watch. God's time and our time are not always the same. Number four, one of our greatest enemies is fear. Because fear can prevent you from doing things that you ought to do. And they were scared to death. And I'm not saying they shouldn't have been scared to death. But fear prevents us from doing what we can do and what we're able to do. Number five, Peter was fine until he took his eyes off Jesus. And when he started thinking about the water instead of thinking about Jesus, that's when Peter found himself sinking. And I think there's a moral right there. That when your mind is on Jesus, things are going to be okay. When you focus on the Word, when you focus on what we're supposed to do, you're going to be okay. When your mind is on things that it shouldn't be, when we don't focus on Jesus, when we start focusing on that nonsense on the television, when we start focusing on those movies and the things that we shouldn't, you're going to sink, just like Peter did. Make sure we keep our eyes on Jesus. And finally, many simply do not understand what Jesus offers. And sadly, the apostles didn't understand. They just could not quite get it. But let me tell you, there's people today that are the same way. They just don't understand what Jesus offers. They want Jesus to provide them food. They want Jesus to provide them with this and with that. And they want the church to be more of a social institution. They just don't understand what Jesus offers. Jesus offers eternal life. And sometimes I don't think that's what people want. People want instant gratification. That's not what Jesus offers. So there's your thoughts this evening. The story of Jesus walking on the water.